What a great group. And for a Friday night, getting this many people out, I know you're here to learn something. And you are. You're going to learn some very interesting things. And from a man who is totally qualified to be able to tell you these things, let me tell you a little bit about this very special man in my life. Dr. Rollins. He is a retired university professor teaching at the University of Missouri, Rolla, and West Virginia University in Morgantown, and BYU Hawaii over in La'i'e. He is a scientist with a background in chemistry, physical science, mathematics, geology, properties of rocks, nuclear energy, and research. He has an international reputation in the field of explosives and blasting, and he has been listed in 12 sources of scientific personnel and who's who in America. Pretty impressive, right? But this only speaks to part of this man. Ron was born in the church, the first of 9 children. His father liked to say that he stopped at 9 because he didn't want to have to give the 10th one to the bishop. He has served in many capacities in the church, including being a bishop. He has worked as an ordinance worker in 4 different temples and has served 5 full-time missions. I met him in 1992 when I was going to BYU Hawaii as a non-traditional student after the death of my husband and after serving a mission. And Ron had lost his wife at that time, and things just really clicked. It was a very fast romance. In 2 weeks, we were engaged. So let me tell you, it goes fast over there under those clear blue skies. he was working at BYU Hawaii as an education missionary. And he was brought over to take the place of one of the professors who was going to be teaching at the Air Force Academy. Well, what ended up to be 2 years went on to be 5 years. It was hard to leave. Between us, we have 10 children, 5 boys and 5 girls, and 31 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. And out of all those grandchildren and great-grandchildren, there's only 6 girls. All the rest are boys. I say to you that you're going to be hearing some things tonight that Ron could never vocally express while he was a university professor. You know, doctors have to get their funding to run their departments and to run their research, and people out there don't like to hear some of the things that some of us might have to say, especially some of the things that Ron's going to share with you tonight. And so understand, it may be the first time you're hearing it. You may have heard it from other entities, but he is professor and an expert in his fields and can back up the information that he's sharing with you with truth. And that's what I wanted to share with you today, that truth, no matter what discipline it's in, is always going to be in agreement with itself. Truth will always prevail. I want you to take what he shares with you today, and I'd like you to ponder it and to really think about it, and then go to the source of all truth and ask if what you've heard tonight is not the truth. And I'm very happy for all of you that have come out tonight. We enjoyed the trip down, and I know we're going to enjoy this evening with you. Let me just share one more thing that has to do with his open question time. Ron will stay here as long as you want him to. Normally what he does when he gives his presentation, he'll say, "I'll get that later," like you might have a question, because he knows some of the ones you're really going to be asking. He's given this presentation in 5 European countries and throughout the West. And so we know the questions that come forward. But when he brings it to a close, he's not running out that door. I've seen him stay behind and answer every question that there is to ask. So if someone wants to stay later, you'll be able to. He'll answer all your questions. Thank you.
Thank you for those kind words. If any of you are going to give a presentation, have your spouse introduce you, and they'll say nice things. By a show of hands, how many of you have a birthday today, plus or minus a week? Oh, look at that. Several of you. Well, congratulations. You have just successfully completed another trip around the sun, a distance of some 583 million miles. Just a month ago, on the 1st of January, we celebrated New Year's Day, and in our Earth, our planet Earth, has also completed another trip around the sun and is 1 year older. And tonight I'm going to be talking about one of my most favorite subjects, the age of the Earth, and things that pertain to the Earth as we know it now. In the church, we are gratefully blessed to have four accounts of the creation of the Earth. We have the one in the Old Testament in Genesis. We have the one in Moses, the one in Abraham. And where's the fourth one? In the temple. This is optional. You don't need to raise your hand if you don't want to. But how many of you have been to the temple and are familiar with the creation account in the temple? Well, almost everyone here. Let me ask one other question. How many of you feel or believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old? How many feel or believe that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old? If you can. I believe that if something is true, it's true. Whether you learn it from your own thinking, whether you learn it from school, from education, from science, whether you learn it from the church, from the scriptures, independent of the source, if it's true, it has to be self-consistent. You cannot have truth from one source that is incompatible or does not agree with truth from another source. If they're not in agreement, then either one or both are incorrect and will be corrected. And this is happening all the time. Think back to looking over at the group 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago when you were in school. The science that you were being taught was being taught as true. The science that's being taught in the schools today is being taught as true. And it's incredible how much of it has changed and been corrected. I'll give you just one example. When I was in school, I was taught that outer space was a vacuum. There was nothing out there. It was just void. When we developed rockets and started sending rockets into space with instrumentation, they detected one particle per cubic meter. Well, that's not very much, but there's a lot of cubic meters out there. That has been corrected and updated to one particle per cubic centimeter. That is a lot more than than the 1 per meter, and it's a lot more than just a vacuum. This is just a partial list of some of the major catastrophic events that are not really accepted by science. The creation of the earth, Adam and Eve, Noah and the flood, Pangaea and the land divided, the crucifixion, the second coming. And I'll be talking a little more about some of these in just a minute. I'd like to quickly review just a few. Earlier someone asked me if it was okay to take notes. The answer is yes. Take all the notes you want. And for those that are interested, there's a copy of the book in the back that has all of these scriptures and so on in it. But I'd like to quickly review just a few scriptures. The one in Genesis where God created the earth and his heaven in 6 days. The one in Abraham where the earth was formed from already existing matter. Yonder is matter unorganized. We will go down and organize this material into a world. In science, when someone finds a rock and they correctly date it at 4.5 billion years old, they conclude that the earth must be at least that old because I found a piece of it that is. I mean, that sounds logical, doesn't it? But what they don't know is that the earth was organized from pre-existing material that was unorganized. That material can be as old as you want. I like to make a comparison with a building. According to the plaque on this building, it was built in 1991, which makes the building, 22 or 3 years old? The building is constructed of wood and metal and rock and glass and construction materials. If the building was dated by the materials of construction, how old would the building be? Could have any age you wanted, depending on what part of the building you found and dated. The same as, see the comparison with the earth? The earth was created or organized from pre-existing unorganized material of whatever age that it happened to have. This building was created and organized from pre-existing material of different ages. So the only way you can really tell how old the building is by being there when it was built and maybe helping build it. And then you know how old it is. Well, the same is true of the earth. None of us were there, but we have information and records from those that were. Genesis, the waters were gathered to one place and the dry land appeared. The days of Peleg, the earth was divided. In 2 Peter, one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is a day. He just mentions it. He doesn't explain it. In Psalms, for 1,000 years in thy sight are as but yesterday. I like the creation account in Abraham because he uses the word time instead of the word day. The first time they did this and this. The second time they did this and this and so on. You remember when Adam and Eve were in the garden and they were commanded not to partake of the fruit of that tree? For in the day that thou doest, thou shalt surely die. How long did Adam live? 930 years? Almost one day of the Lord's measurement of time. Not according to our manner of reckoning time, but according to the Lord's manner of reckoning time. And he explained to Abraham that that the creation of the earth was after his manner of reckoning time because the time assigned to Adam hadn't been given to him yet. Using this conversion factor gives some interesting things to ponder on. If you take one day of the Lord's time is equal to 1,000 of our years, if you divide his day into 24 hours, that means that one of his hours is equal to about 42 of our years. So those of you that are about 42 years of old, you've only been out of the presence of your heavenly parents for 1 hour. That's interesting, isn't it? If you live until you're 84, you'll only be gone from his presence for 2 hours. Unfortunately, there are many individuals that come down to the earth to get their body and go through this mortal experience who are only here for a matter of seconds or minutes. But some of us make it for that 2 hours. So they don't really trust us to be out of their presence for very long. I'd like to take about 4 or 5 minutes and talk about carbon-14 dating for just a minute. Carbon-14 is formed in the atmosphere by the interaction of nitrogen and a neutron that comes zipping in from outer space. And the carbon-14 reacts with oxygen to form carbon dioxide, which is a nutrient for anything that's green. So it's absorbed in the trees and in the plants and the vegetables and the vegetation and the grass and gets in the vegetables and you eat the vegetables and it gets in you. The cows eat the grass and it gets in the cows and you eat the cows and it gets in you. So you're all radioactive. Fortunately, it's not enough to hurt you or bother you, but it's enough to be able to detect and measure. Carbon-14 has a half-life, and it decays, and it goes back to nitrogen. And this is the ratio of buildup of carbon-14 in the atmosphere. It has a half-life of 5,730 years. What that means is if you have 100 atoms of carbon-14, that after 5,730 years, you only have half that many. And after that many more years, you'll only have half that many. And so after about 6 half-lives, most or all of it is gone, is decayed and gone back to nitrogen. It takes about 6 half-lives, or about 34,000 years, to reach equilibrium. So at time zero, when it started to form, and then as it's forming after it eventually starts to decay, but when the rate of formation is equal to the rate of decay, then the amount in the environment is constant, isn't it? The equilibrium count is 21.3 counts per gram per minute. The measured value is 14.5. This ratio says that it's only reached 68% of the equilibrium value. And if we plot that equation, it shows a growth rate. At time zero, there wasn't any. It's reached 68% of the equilibrium value, which corresponds to an age of 6,000 years. I find that very interesting, that corrected carbon-14 dating dates the atmosphere as 6,000 years old in agreement with Scripture, so it must be right. This raises some interesting questions. One, if the atmosphere is only 6,000 years old, the dinosaurs lived 200 million years ago, what did they breathe? Another question, is it possible to explain everything that has happened on this earth in 6,000 years? And the answer is yes. This map shows the, I'm going to talk next about what I call an ice cap model. When Adam and Eve were ushered out of the Garden of Eden, the earth became temporal or mortal or telestial, and this I call this time zero. And carbon-14 started to form in the atmosphere, and prior to this time, according to the account in Moses, there was no birth or death on the earth, so hence no fossils. At time zero, you start evaporating water from the oceans and so on. Some of it will fall back as rain, and some of it is deposited at the North and South Pole as ice. And at the current average rate of precipitation, we can ask the question, how long would it take to accumulate enough ice to provide enough weight on the north and south ends of Pangaea to overcome the strength of the rock and crack it? This shows what the ice cap looked like at the northern pole, and it extended down this direction towards the border of the U.S. and Canada. And here it went further down in the states of Missouri and in that area. And when, let me mention one other thing I haven't mentioned yet. When the earth was originally created and organized, there was one land mass and one water mass, and the land mass was flat. It didn't have any mountains. And some of the scriptures that we have that tell us this is that the earth is going to return to the form that in which it was when it was originally created. The mountains will be made low. You're going to lose your beautiful mountain up here. The mountains are going to be made low, and the valleys are going to be raised up, and the land masses are going to be joined back together again. And the land was flat. It's interesting that this information continued down through the generations and still existed at the time of Columbus, for example. At the time of Columbus, they thought that if you got on a ship and sailed across the ocean, you'd come to the edge, and you'd fall over the edge into oblivion and never be heard from again. For those of you that are interested, there is a flat earth society. You can go on the internet and get some information on how to join the flat earth society. To show you how serious they are, here are some of the questions on the application form. Besides your name and address and email and so on, your favorite color, your favorite jelly bean flavor, your favorite radioactive isotope. I don't know how that got in there. How did you find our webpage? Who is your favorite historical figure? Rasputin, Napoleon Bonaparte, or Attila the Hun? Well, so the Flat Earth Society still exists, and it is possible to become a member if any of you are interested. So you can explain all of the ice ages from this one original ice cap. As the ice was being accumulated on the north and south ends of Pangaea, which is Greek for all lands united and the original single flat continent. As the ice was accumulating, it would flow down in certain areas and then would recede and then come down again and recede. And you can explain all of the ice ages as this one major ice cap. Now, the interesting question is, how long would it take to accumulate enough ice to overcome the granite, this original continent, and split it into pieces? The northern ice cap covered about 12 million square miles. It was 2 to 3 miles deep, and it had a force of 10,000 billion tons. This is sufficient to crack the solid rock. And here you can see the crack. For those of you in the back, it's kind of an eye test, but for those of you that are sitting up closer, you can see the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which goes down through here. Then it comes up the other side as the East Pacific Rise. This fracture went completely around the Earth. It traveled at about 4,300 miles an hour, and it took about 6 hours to go completely around. And it's been dated by carbon-14 dating as having occurred about 3,000 BC. This corresponds with Noah and the flood. When Noah got the instruction and the warning from the Lord to build something that would float, it wasn't really built to go anywhere because there was nowhere to go. It was just built to float, wasn't it? And the flood was about 2350 BC, which was about 1,650 years after Adam. This means that the dinosaur age only lasted some 1,650 years, because at the time of Noah and the flood, they were all wiped out. The crack started at the North Pole and proceeded southward, and as it was forming, you had the lava coming up from below, the water and ice falling in from above, creating a cataclysmic upheaval that not only split the original continent into fragments, but also drove it apart. On this side, they were being driven in this direction. On this side, they were being driven in this direction. Now, the resistance to stop this movement was along the western coast, wasn't it? And this is where all of the high uplift mountains are. They were pushed up by the movement of these continental fragments in this direction. Same thing is true over in Europe. You have the mountains along this side. And in a minute, I'll show you a map of the reconstruction of Pangaea. And it turns out that Australia and India came from the polar region, and India came up this way and slammed into Asia and pushed up the Himalayas and all this high country. And looking at this map, it's very logical. Australia was moving in this direction. The resistance to stop it was on this side, and this is where all the mountains are. It turns out that the Mediterranean and the Caribbean were the hinge points where there was some rotation taking place as the fragments were being pushed apart. And if you look at the map of Africa, looks like there's a piece that's missing right here. It turns out that Italy fits right in that piece. Not approximately, but exactly. So that when Pangaea was being disrupted and pulled apart, Italy was pulled out and slammed into Europe and pushed up the Alps. And that's how they were formed. So all of the mountains were formed in connection with the disruption of Pangaea and Noah and the flood. My wife and I were serving a mission in Switzerland at the temple in 2003, 4, and 5. And, well, I've got a slide on that, so I'll wait just a minute. Back in 1880, a German scientist, Wegener, came up with the idea of the origin of continents. And what he did is he looked at a map, but instead of looking at the coastline, he looked at the continental shelf, which is the light blue part on the map. And he said, you know, it looks like if you took a map and a pair of scissors and cut out these continents around the continental shelf, they'd look like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that would fit together. One of the most obvious fits is with South America and Africa. It fits exactly, and the geologic formations match up, which is further evidence that they were joined. Yes, they were joined together. My wife got her degree in elementary education, and she taught fifth grade for a while. And when they were talking about the Earth and the continents, one of their assignments was to take a map and a pair of scissors and cut out the continents around the continental shelf and see how they fit together. And I've talked to several fifth grade teachers. Do we happen to have any here that have done this exercise in their class? And the students found it very interesting. It turns out that when Wegener presented this information, he was laughed off the stage. They said, that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. How could these huge continental blocks float around on the ocean floor? Well, they don't. Subsequent investigation found a boundary between the lithosphere, which are the surface rocks, and the asthenosphere, which are the deeper rocks. And it's along this boundary that the movement actually takes place. Yeah, I've already covered that. Some people have wondered, with the height of the mountains, how could the entire Earth have been covered with water? But what they don't know is the Earth was flat. When the rupture took place, using Krakatoa as an example, when Krakatoa volcano down in the Pacific Island erupted back in 1875, it sent a tidal wave that went around the Earth four times. It started out 100 feet high, and of course it got smaller and smaller. Some of you might remember a movie they made of this called East of Eden. And I remember there was a big liner at sea, and the captain gave the passengers the option of staying on the ship or going on shore on an island. Some of them went on the island and died in the resulting tsunami. The ones that stayed on the ship survived. Here came this 100-foot tidal wave, but the ship was able to ride through it and survive. Compared to this, Krakatoa was like a little firecracker. When the eruption on Pangaea occurred, it must have created a tidal wave that swept over the land masses and completely covered them. In addition to the rain that was falling, the tidal wave would have been much more destructive and would have killed all the animals. One interesting example of this, again, the rupture started in the north. The ice and water and rock was thrown up in the air. The prevailing winds are in this direction. They came down over here in Siberia. And in that area, they have found these large mastodons. They were standing erect with their legs slightly bent, covered under 50 feet of tundra, which is a mixture of the ice and rock and water, with buttercups in their mouth. They'd been grazing in lush tropical meadows, and their mouth and their stomach was filled with these tropical plants. They were completely covered and asphyxiated and entombed in less time than they had to swallow. And where it came down and hit right over them, and then on the edges it kind of went whoosh like this. And they find that the animals on the outer edges were pushed across the countryside and piled up in the ravines, and their bones were all broken, and they couldn't explain it. But the ice cap model explains it very nicely. They hunt for these mastodons to get the ivory, and when they find them, the meat is still fresh, and they feed it to their sled dogs. So it couldn't have happened millions of years ago. In fact, some of you might have caught a recent program where they actually excavated one of these mammoths, and they were taking it into a laboratory to study it. They kept it encased in ice, and interesting enough, they might try to clone it. Have any of you seen Jurassic Park? Yeah. Be interesting if they could bring a mammoth back alive, wouldn't it? This shows the matchup of South America and Africa. And here's a reconstruction of Pangaea, showing how the different, here's North America and Arabia and so on. Europe is down in here. Here's Australia and India. This has been one of the questions in geology for a long time, is they've known that India came from a polar region because it's covered with cap rock that is only found in polar regions. But they didn't know how it got from down here to where it is now. But again, the ice cap model explains this very nicely. Oh, skip through the maps. We don't need those. Have any of you been to Switzerland and seen the Matterhorn? Oh, look at all the hands. It's a beautiful sight, isn't it? Besides the time we spent in Switzerland, we've been fortunate to get there a couple of times. It's a beautiful mountain. Kind of strange looking, though, isn't it? This is an article from, it's in German, if any of you read German. But the thing that's interesting about it, and the Swiss version of the National Geographic Society released this information when we were over there in 2004. And what they found was that the rocks at the top of the mountain are different than the rocks at the base of the mountain. And not only that, they came from North Africa. Not only on the Matterhorn, but on the Weisshorn and Mont Blanc. And I have a feeling that if they investigated all of the mountains in the Alps, they would find this was true of all of them. Because again, Italy pulled out of North Africa, and rotated during the disruption of Pangaea, rotated and slammed into Europe, and it carried these rocks from North Africa, which it deposited on top of the land, and then pushed it up, forming the mountains. And that's why these rocks from North Africa are on top of the mountain range in the Alps. When I gave this presentation in Italy and in Switzerland to those from Italy, they really liked this. They felt that giving Italy the credit for forming the Alps was a good thing. Mount St. Helens, very quickly and briefly, any of you remember when Mount St. Helens erupted? Yeah. Were any of you there? I don't know if I still have it, but we lived up in the Coeur d'Alene area in Idaho for a while, and that area was all covered with dust. And I used to have a vial of the dust from Mount St. Helens. But the reason I wanted to mention this is this happened back in 1980, and half a cubic mile of rock slid off the volcano, and the resulting steam explosion was equivalent to 20 million tons of TNT. Anybody know anything interesting about that number? That's the same amount of energy released by the atomic bombs dropped on Japan. Some 600 feet of strata were formed at the site from landslide, mud flows, airfall, stream water. Stratified layers up to 25 feet thick were formed, which normally, according to conventional geology, takes eons of time. A 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon was formed. Trees and debris in Spirit Lake. And my wife and I took a trip up there, and we saw Spirit Lake, and the trees that were in it, within about 10 years after the event, had already started to form coal. Given the proper set of conditions, coal forms very rapidly. Here is the canyon itself, the Little Grand Canyon on the Toutle River, a 1/50th scale of the Grand Canyon. It was formed very, very rapidly. Have any of you been to the Grand Canyon? Practically everybody. I remember when I was in college, we went to the Grand Canyon on a geology field trip. We were standing on the south rim looking over that big hole in the ground, and the professor pointed out the different formations and how old they were and how the Grand Canyon was formed, and I didn't believe it then and I don't believe it now. What you need three conditions. What three conditions do you need to form the Grand Canyon very rapidly in maybe a week or less? You need a lot of water. You need a lot of water. You need an uplift. And need some fracturing of the rock. Using Third Nephi as an example of what happened at the time of the crucifixion, on this, on the Americas, there is tremendous disruption, wasn't there? Cataclysmic events. Earthquakes and mountains formed and cities buried and destroyed. And at one time, the Great Salt Lake was a part of Lake Bonneville, which covered a very large area of the West. And my feeling is that one other thing. If you look at this crack that went clear around the Earth, it came up this side of the East Pacific Rise, and off of the main crack, you have these side fractures. The large ones have names, like the Murray fracture zone. Any brittle material that breaks or fractures will have the main fracture with side cracks that come off of it. This fracture zone goes right into the Grand Canyon area. So it was in a fractured area. It's on the Kaibab Plateau, which is an uplift. And my feeling is at the time of the crucifixion of the Savior, as described in 3 Nephi, you had natural rock barriers that were holding back the water of Lake Bonneville that were broken down by all of this disruption going on and allowed the water to be released. And some of it went through the Grand Canyon area. Some of it went north through Idaho. And one of the interesting things, if you follow the Colorado River down to where it empties into the Gulf of California, and I know you can probably see it, but you'll have to take my word for it back there. This light blue area again represents the continental shelf, and here's a light blue area in the Gulf of California where the material from the erosion of the Grand Canyon was deposited. And they've gone down and they've measured the volume of that material, and guess what? It's just enough to fill in that big hole in the ground. Here's some more views of the canyon. Now this one, you can see the effect of a large volume of water going through this area from the scouring that was caused by the movement of rocks and boulders as they were being pushed by the water. Another interesting thing about the Grand Canyon, if you fly over it in an airplane, look down at it, it looks like a big crack in the ground, which it is. And there's a lot more we could say about this, but one other thing. The Grand Canyon, normally when a river or water will seek the path of least resistance, won't it? It'll go around a hill, for example. The Grand Canyon cuts right across the Kaibab Plateau. It couldn't have done that unless a very large volume of water was released very rapidly, and that's the way it went. Let's talk about dinosaurs for a minute. Remember earlier I talked about how things change? A few years back, this is a Time magazine from 1983. And on the cover, it shows a picture of a dinosaur. And it says, "The truth about dinosaurs. Surprise, just about everything you believe is wrong." And the lead article is on rewriting the book on dinosaurs. Forget what you knew. They weren't necessarily cold-blooded or pea-brained and may not really be extinct. That's interesting, isn't it? issue of National Geographic had an article on a fish called the coelacanth, which is a fossil that they have found in rocks dating back 100 million years. And it's thought to have been gone extinct with the dinosaurs. And it turns out that off the coast of Madagascar, they catch them and eat them every day. It's a large fish. Weighs about 300 pounds, so you can feed a lot of people. And it's a very interesting fish. It has some very interesting characteristics. And the living ones they find are just exactly like the fossils that they find in the rocks. They have found human footprints and dinosaur footprints side by side. For geologists, it's just as bad to find horse footprints alongside dinosaur tracks as humans. A Japanese fishing boat caught a dead plesiosaur. A plesiosaur is about 30 feet long, lives in the ocean, and has a long neck. If the Loch Ness creature really exists, it's a plesiosaur. But anyway, they caught one. And they brought it on board the boat and took some pictures of it and some sketches and some samples to take back. When they got back to port, they reported it. And then they threw it overboard because they didn't want it to spoil their boatload of fish. When they got back to port, they reported it, they were very unhappy with them. And they immediately sent them out again, along with some Russians and Koreans and others, into the same area to see if they could find it. And the Russians were told that if you find it and you get it on board and can't stand the smell, you're to jump overboard. This is a plesiosaur, again, they find in the fossils and have been thought to have been extinct for a million years. Here's a picture of the coelacanth. The Old Testament in Job talks about the behemoth and the leviathan. If you haven't read the description of these creatures recently, do it again. The behemoth is described as a very briefly as a apatosaurus-type dinosaur, very large. And said that when it leaned over to get a drink out of the river, you'd think it was going to drink the river dry. I mean, it's talking about a large animal. The leviathan, somewhat similar to a Tyrannosaurus rex, had a heavy plating and wasn't afraid of the hunters with their darts and their spears and their arrows. He laughed at them. There have been accounts of living dinosaurs in Zaire. They have, during the time of the dinosaurs, they lived all over Pangaea. They were everywhere. And they have found many nesting sites. They found one in South America, in Argentina. It's about 100 kilometers long and about 50 kilometers wide, where the dinosaurs would gather, like birds and pelicans do, to build their nests and to reproduce. And the interesting thing about these sites is they show evidence of being destroyed by a large volume of water, by flooding. And they find the eggs with the fossilized embryos inside of them. There was a report that in Nepal, which is a little country just off of the edge of India, of some living mammoths that were not elephants. Elephants, see, look at the head, how it's kind of flat, and the back is kind of flat. And they sent an expedition to look for these mammoths, and you notice the round domes on the head, and the back is humped. They kind of look like elephants, but they're not. They were able to collect some of their waste and analyze it, and they're not elephants. They're a completely different creature. Well, the thought that went through my head, when we read the account in the Ether about the Gerardites and the animals that they had, it starts with the little ones, and then it gets up to the larger ones, and the elephants and the curulims and the cumans. I think when the Book of Mormon was being translated, or the Jaredite record was being translated, I think they used words that the people were familiar with, so they knew about elephants, but they didn't know what curulims and cumans were, so I don't think they translated those words. I think they kept the word in the original Adamic language. But wouldn't it be interesting if these are living curulims or cumans? It's a little speculation. Leonardo is an interesting dinosaur. He was found on the border between the U.S. and Canada. And the thing that's interesting and unique about him, here's his tail, and here's his head. But you'll notice that usually when they find some dinosaurs, they find a few bones. They put them together to see what the original animal looked like. Here was a whole complete dinosaur. Not only that, but he's a mummified duck-billed dinosaur, Brachiosaurus. His skeleton is covered with soft tissue, the skin, scales, muscle, foot pads, and even his last meal in his stomach, a half-digested clump of 40 different types of ferns. So he was a vegetarian. He was dated by the formation they found him in. They dated him at 77 million years old. I say he was buried and mummified and mummified at the time of the flood. And he's only a couple of thousand years old. He was about 22 feet long, weighed 1.5 to 2 tons, and he was buried in a thick sandstone rock layer close to Yellowstone Park, probably killed by a giant cataclysm that buried him and preserved him, plus the plants in his stomach. This reminds me briefly, have any of you been to Alaska? Boy, look at all the hands. I was talking to a friend that works up on the North Shore in Alaska, and where they're drilling for oil. And when they drill for oil, they use a hollow drill. It's called a core drill, so they can extract the cores and analyze them and see what's in it. When they're drilling down through the rock, they always go through a thick layer of vegetation. And bringing this material up and examining it, one of the managers had some of the seed pods that were recovered on his desk. And one of his friends was visiting one day, and he was showing them to him. And he said, say, have you ever thought about planting those to see if they'll sprout and see if they'll grow? No. So he did. And they did. And they grew tropical plants that were abundant in that area at the time that they were buried. Precambrian rocks, there are no fossils. The Cambrian rocks have billions of fossils. And I've mentioned a few of the different kinds. But the question is, how could the fossils all of a sudden appear when they weren't there before? And how can it be possible that many of these fossils, which are considered to have been extinct for millions of years, are still living? Like the coelacanth and others. They find no transitions between the fossils. In fact, the fossil record is good evidence for a worldwide catastrophic event, the flood. They estimated 4,600 species of mammals, 10,000 species of birds, about 28,000 species of fish, 800,000 species of insects, and no intermediates among all of them. When the earth was created and they were placed on the earth, they were commanded to what? Reproduce after their own kind. Very briefly, a little bit on human evolution theory. The Java man was formed from a skull cap and three teeth. The Piltdown man turned out to be a hoax and was an ape bone. The Rhodesian man had dental caries and a bullet hole in his scalp. The Tong man was a young ape. The Nebraska man was formed from a single molar tooth. It was later shown to be the tooth of an extinct pig. In 1972, they found these pigs living in Paraguay. Peking man You've all heard of him. And Lucy, who's an Eight Bones, the Nutcracker Man. The entire bone inventory in 1972 was just scraps and pieces, about 1,400 pieces. Baby apes and giant monkeys both look like immature humans. It turns out that I've been reading some recent articles on some gene studies that they're doing. And the genes between you, humans, and monkeys are different. They couldn't be connected or related. Man is different from the apes. He has different DNA and so on. In fact, I'd like to briefly tell a story. When I was in high school down in California, we had a fellow on our football team, tremendous football player. He played center. This was a few years ago, so he played center on offense and center linebacker on defense. He was kind of hunched over. He had the features and face bones and of a large ape. In fact, we affectionately called him Monk. I'm convinced that if he wandered off into the woods one day and fell down a hole and was buried, 100 years later, they would find his bones. He would be dated by the formation that they found him in. He'd be 100 million years old, and he'd be the missing link, the Monk Man. All flesh is not the same flesh. Flesh of man, flesh of beasts, and so on. The human brain. How many of you have one? Being compared to a computer with a capacity of 10 to the 15th bits, of which we only use 10 to the 6th. This leaves a difference of 10 to the 9th, which is a billion. How could the human brain evolve to a capacity 1 billion times greater than we need or use? Evolution cannot answer that question. But the gospel can and does. Your brain served you in your premortal life. It serves you here and now. And it'll serve you as a glorified, resurrected, exalted, celestialized being for all eternity. You need a brain with that much capacity in order to learn and to do everything that you're going to be doing. That's why the brain has that much capacity. Well, there's more I could talk about, but let me close with this thought. Never substitute the wisdom of man for the revelations of God. The gospel is true. Both the scriptures and the gospel and scientific evidence, which is accumulating at a rapid rate, are in agreement that the earth is indeed 6,000 years old, as it says in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 77. Where it says that the earth was created in 6 days or 1 week of the Lord's time, and then the seventh day they rested. It had 1 week assigned to it for its mortal probationary experience, and the seventh day is the millennium. And we're at the end of the sixth day, aren't we? If you don't have your food storage, I encourage you to get it ready. Thank you. Anybody have a question?
Yes. A doctor in Nashville told me that they took a sample of one of the anchor stones on the ark, and they analyzed the rock, and they said that the only place that it could have come from was Santee County in Utah. And that we know that that's a very important place, aren't we? Could you address that specifically?
Where was the Garden of Eden? Adamondayaman, which is in Missouri. And when Adam and Eve were ushered out of the garden, they didn't have hiking boots. They didn't have a year's supply. My feeling is that they didn't really go very far. They looked for food and shelter and a place where they could survive in the immediate vicinity. In fact, we have the information on this because as Adam was getting near the end of his life, he called everybody together into a council, didn't he? And so they must have all been still living in that area. Well, they could have wandered a little ways from there. And Utah is really not that far, so it's possible. We don't really have any information on that from the scriptures, but we know that that's where the Garden of Eden was, and that's where Noah started from.
When you were explaining carbon dating, and you said the atmosphere was about 6,000 years old, when they generally date the Earth in the billions or millions of years, are they using the same carbon dating? How did they come up with those numbers?
That's a good question. You cannot use carbon-14 dating for anything that's older than maybe 20,000 years because it's all gone. See, while the animal, the dinosaur or you, are alive, you're accumulating carbon-14 in your body. When you die, you stop accumulating it, but the amount in there is decaying, isn't it? And so what they do is they take a sample and they analyze it and they measure the counts per gram per minute and see how it looks on that growth curve and compared to the equilibrium value. And that's how they approximate the date. And if it's done correctly, it's pretty accurate. But it's only good for about 20,000 years. So when they date a rock at 4.5 billion years, they're not using carbon-14. They're using other radioactive isotopes, which have half-lives measured in millions of years. And I had some information on this on radio halos, and I could talk about this for another hour, so maybe I can come back again sometime.
One more question. On the story we read of Noah's Ark, a lot of animals were destroyed during this flood, but how do you account for, I'm not an animal or insect guy, the millions and billions of species we have today, if they were all destroyed, they wouldn't all fit on the Ark.
That's a very good question. How did all these... Earlier I gave a little summary of the different number of species of animals and birds and fish and so on, insects. It's a large number. And did they all survive on the ark? Well, the life forms in the sea, some of those probably survived. The land, the dinosaurs were wiped out, most of them. As far as the birds and the insects and the other life forms, we don't really know, do we? They didn't all evolve from a single pair on the ark, we know that. Not given enough time. Evolution requires eons of time. 6,000 years is not enough. Yes?
When it speaks about the fountains of the great deep being broken up, I have about a three-part question. The earth was in some kind of a terrarium state with really no climate or weather. I've heard. So... I want you to comment on that, and some of the larger bone structures they're finding, the giants in the land, spoken of in Genesis, and the hollow earth theory.
About 7 years ago, my wife and I were traveling through Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we stopped overnight. The next day, we went to one of the Indian museums there. If you ever get a chance and you're going through Albuquerque, go to the Indian museums there. They're very interesting. And this one we went to, one section of the museum was dedicated to what they call their emergence. In their legends, they have information that has come down that they originated underground. And then when the time came, a way to the surface was made possible, and they came out on the surface. And in the legend, the land was flat. And life was very easy. The food was abundant, and the climate was favorable, and they became, what's the word I want? Not wicked or idle. They became idolatrous, and so the Lord punished them by creating mesas and mountains and disrupting the land. But in their legend, they came from underground, and the land was flat when they came out on the land. There are scriptures that refer to things on the surface and below the surface. We don't have much more than that. The rest is speculation. The earth is a living being, isn't it? It's feminine. We talk about Mother Nature and Mother Earth. She was born, created, organized. She was baptized. She's going to die eventually, be resurrected and exalted and celestialized and be the celestial home for all of you. We're all going to make it, right? But where are the 10 lost tribes? They could be underground somewhere. We don't know if they're on this earth with a veil separating them from us so we can't contact them, or whether they're underground somewhere, which is very possible. But we know that they're going to be restored. So when the call comes from the prophet to go to Missouri and help build the temple and do the ordinance work for them, be ready. Yeah.
I always think of those Alaskan mosquitoes, you know, state birds, because you can, they're about this big and you can feel them and they light on you. But anyway, there's no reason not to think that there couldn't be pockets within the earth that were protected with air from the water, either underneath the water or in land that was eventually pushed up or whatever, where certain things were preserved and then brought about at a later time as part of the full story as we, you know, unwind towards our final end.
Another possibility is that when the land was covered with water, a lot of the eggs were buried and preserved and and later exposed and hatched, like the mosquitoes do in swamps and so on.
Oops. Where do you think oil actually comes from? Do you really think it's from the dinosaurs?
There's one other item of interest I thought I'd share briefly. They recently found some, they've been doing some DNA research on dinosaur proteins, and the DNA that they have found in the dinosaur cells. An interesting thing about DNA is it has a half-life of about 521 years. And so after six about half-lives, about 3,000 years, all of the DNA would have been decomposed and gone. And yet they are finding, they are reporting DNA from various fossils, including dinosaur bones. And it could not have lasted a half a million years that they say that these dinosaurs lived. So information like this is starting to surface. If you keep your eyes and ears open, you'll see something almost every day of a recent discovery or something new that is in agreement with the scriptures. So it must be true. The interesting thing to me as a scientist is they don't know about the scriptures.
So can you explain to me why the carbon dating always says that everything is older than the 6,000 years?
When Libby, very briefly, when Libby was developing his carbon-14 dating technique back in the 50s, he measured an equilibrium count of 16 grams, or counts per gram per minute. He actually measured less than that, 15.6. But he ascribed the difference to experimental error, because it couldn't be less, because that would date the Earth at less than 30,000 years old, and everybody knows it's millions of years old. Since he was famous and he got a Nobel Prize. But since he did his work, other experimenters with better equipment and improved sampling methods have determined the equilibrium count is 21 and the measured value is only 14.7, which isn't far from what Libby measured, which gives the 68% of the equilibrium value. Well, science does not use the corrected non-equilibrium carbon-14 dating. They use Libby's method, which has errors in it. And sometimes it'll give them a value they like, and sometimes it doesn't. If they don't like it, they discard it. That large depression in the Gulf of Mexico is really thought to have been formed by the meteor impact. It's too big to be a single city. So that's interesting speculation, but I don't think that's where the city of Enoch was. I think it was, well, I don't know. But it was possibly up in the Adamondiaman area somewhere.
I was just curious about that gentleman's question about the oil, and if you think it's a finite supply, did it come from dinosaurs, or do you think it's something else?
I didn't talk about fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. But they were all formed at the same time of the disruption of Pangaea and the movement of the fragments and the burial of the formations. One evidence of this is that in the United States, the high anthracite coals, high carbon content, are found over in this region where the pressure would have been the highest. And then as you head west, the rank of the coal goes down to the bituminous and the subbituminous and the lignite, found out here in Texas, and matches up with the conditions that were happening to bury the material and form the coal when it was happening. Now, where is the oil found? So the coal is found in a narrow band across this way, and the oil is found on each side of it, and there's some up here on the north slope that was formed by different conditions at different times. It's possible to explain the fossil fuel formation and location according to this ice cap model as well.
So what about the Mid East and all the oil they have? Or they may have?
Over here in the Mid East, the oil that they have, some of it is adjacent to these mountain ranges where the pressure would have been adequate. And with the movement of the land masses and the rapid burial of large volumes of vegetation and then the pressure to convert it into the fossil fuels. When, have any of you been in an underground coal mine? Oh, look at all the hands. When I was in West Virginia at the university, we visited a number of the mines. And one of the interesting things about an underground coal mine is you go up to the exposed seam and the gas under high pressure will actually be hissing out of the face of the coal. Have any of you witnessed that? Ask yourself the question that if that vegetation was buried slowly over eons of time and then converted to coal, how and why would all of that pressure still be there? Same thing in an oil well. They drill for oil, they find oil, it comes shooting out because it's under high pressure from the overburden that's pressing down on it, which is another indication that it was formed very rapidly and the high pressure is still there. When the continents were moving apart, it turns out that when something catastrophic like this happens, it takes about 10,000 years to regain what they call isostatic equilibrium, where things kind of settle down. Well, it turns out that we are still moving in a westward direction. Not very much, about a centimeter per year, but it's enough to detect and measure. Same thing up here. All of this light area was covered by this massive weight of ice. And when the ice was removed, the land, which was depressed, started to rise. It's still rising. It hasn't stopped yet. It's still getting back to an equilibrium position. When the pressure decreases to a level where it can't push the oil out, they pump water and other fluids and gases like nitrogen into the ground to pressurize it to help force it out. And in some areas, like the area around Denver, where they've been doing some of this, it's been causing some earthquakes and some problems they didn't really want. But what they're doing is putting more pressure in the ground to get the oil or gas out that's still there that didn't come out.
Into a little hole. And I would imagine you've probably heard some about
didn't apply as we know now. But what's the deal about that report?
Yes, I've seen that report, and it was very interesting. And I don't remember him finding anything down there. They just found his big opening and investigated it a little bit, but...
There's also a book called The Smoky God, which talks about what somebody found also.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that? The Smoky God, the book?
Yeah. Remember, the crack started at the north and went south. And when it hit the bottom end, it had a shattering effect on the bottom of Pangaea. And that's when it broke off India and Australia and some others. And it was moving at about 4,300 miles an hour. It went clear around the earth in about 6 hours. So this was a catastrophic event. It didn't happen over a long period of time. Now, how did they know it was going that fast? If you take a piece of granite into the laboratory and use a Tinius Olsen compression testing machine and apply pressure to it, you can determine its compressive strength and tensile strength. And when it fractures, you can measure the velocity of the fracture in the material, in the sample. So the assumption is made that this was solid granite, and those are the values that apply to granite.
Do you think the water covered the ocean covered the land mass all at the same time?
Yes. Yes, the water, if Krakatoa created a wave 100 feet high, this could have been a wave 1,000 feet high. You know, it's interesting that Antarctica is almost large enough to accumulate enough ice to overcome the strength of the rock and crack it. And it's estimated that if this happened, a wall of water 100 feet high would hit New York City. Don't move to New York. Most of the world's population is on the seacoast, isn't it? So here is if for some reason we had a global cooling and the ice accumulated at a faster rate than it was flowing to the edges and sloughing off and going off to sink the Titanic and do whatever else icebergs do. If the rate of accumulation of the ice was somehow increased, that's a possibility. It could rupture Antarctica. It's almost big enough to support enough ice to do that. Remember, the amount required to rupture Pangaea was... It was 10. It was 12 million square miles, and it exerted a force of 10,000 billion tons. That is a lot of weight. Yeah.
Okay, forgive this question. I'm running a public school system, so I don't quite get everything. But if we agree that 1,000 years is a day, and so the Lord took 6 days to create it, plus the seventh day he rested, that's 7,000 years. And then we have 6,000 years of recorded history. Doesn't that make the earth 13,000 years old, not 6,000?
The creation period started 13,000 years ago, but the earth really didn't become mortal until Adam and Eve were cast out.
Okay.
So in its mortal state, it's only 6,000 years old.
Okay, so technically it's 13, but the mortal state is 6. So is that accurate? Second question. I've read reports of oil fields that were thought to be
according to the ice cap model, all of the fossil fuels and the mountains were formed at the time of the disruption of Pangaea.
So the Earth isn't continuing to regenerate more oil then?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We visited Spirit Lake, and the divers found that the trees at the bottom of the lake at Mount St. Helens are already converted into coal in just a few years. It doesn't take, if you have the right conditions, temperature, moisture, and you need a clay deposit as well, you can form coal very rapidly. They've done it in a laboratory in a week. Yeah.
Same thing with oil
and gas. Can be formed very rapidly.
So it's not an
identity. Yeah, I got my undergraduate degree in fuels engineering, and we studied fossil fuel deposits and hydrocarbons. And I was told a lot of things I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now either. At the time, that was a very rough ride. They probably need a little help to survive.
So it didn't take very long.
Well, they were floated around for what, a year? And before they found land and got off again. Yeah. It's possible, but it's speculation, and
yeah.
Unfortunately we don't have any information on it, but it's possible. Yeah. Good. The earth was created spiritually first, and then at the time of of Noah and the flood, the earth was changed to take on the form of his spiritual creation. Just like you started out as a disorganized intelligence. A spirit body composed of elements was made for you. Combined with your intelligence, you became an individual that was learning and growing and progressing. You came down to this earth as a little baby. And then you grow into the statue of your spiritual creation. And when we're resurrected, we'll return to that form. We won't have the appearance of age. We won't look young or old. We'll all be handsome and beautiful.
So I've heard that the atmosphere changed after the flood. Can you tell us more about that? Because the atom lived almost 1,000 years. So.
Well, the atmosphere changed. The land changed. Essentially everything changed than it was before the flood. Fossilization can occur very rapidly. They have found 30-foot-high trees that were fossilized. And this could not have occurred vertical. This could not have occurred very slowly over a long period of time. From the bottom up, the tree would have died. That's one place. There's also some in Arizona, and there's some here in Utah. I went with my grandfather one time collecting fossilized wood in the north of St. George, up in the Enterprise region, and so on. Well, I mentioned the mammoths in Siberia they have found. The flesh is still good. Leonardo, a complete mummified dinosaur. when I was in Hawaii, there was another fellow there that I knew that had done some work up here in northern Canada. And they found an area where there were seven levels of beaches, different levels of the ocean at one time where the water had been. And then the land had risen to expose these different levels. And in the upper level, they found a whale entombed in the ice. And they extracted a sample of it and sent it in to have it dated to see how old it was. Do you think it was thousands of years old or millions of years old? Corresponded to Noah and the flood. Right here in this area of North America where the edge of that ice cap was, the boundary is very evident. And they have analyzed vegetation on the one side and compared it to the other side, and they've dated it. It also corresponds to the time of Noah and the flood. So they keep finding more and more things like this that add more pieces or more pieces to the picture puzzle to make the picture more complete.
Children. How do I make sure, I mean, the only way I've figured out how to do it is to pull them out of school.
Well, I think
Yeah.
Well, it's really funny because Ron has had students that have emailed him back and forth because they've had the discussions in their classes, and Ron's given them some answers and questions to bring right back to the teacher again. Well, then why this? And what we're wanting our students, our young people, to do is to think, to use these wonderful brains they've been given, and to not take what is written in a textbook to be the gospel. He started out by telling you that what I was taught about science back in school in the 50s and the 60s is not the same thing as being taught now. Science is constantly correcting itself, but remember, it doesn't like to move very fast.
Okay. I have a comment I want to make on that in closing, but first, two last questions.
Well, I was going to make a question. The world we live in is this: truth is eternal, facts constantly change.
I used to believe in the 6,000-year-old theory until I became a geologist.
Oh.
And obviously, I've been taught false doctrine by the way you've been talking tonight. And you have given me a lot of things to ponder about, think about. But, you know, one of the things that helped convince me that the world was older was the radioactive dating, not carbon dating, but radioactive dating and fission tracking dating. So I hope you do come back again and explain.
That dates the age of the rock, but not the Earth.
Well, but when you look at the patterns of the Earth and the layers and things, it's not haphazardly put together. There is uniformity. So, you know, I would like to have a better understanding on your idea of radioactive dating and things. And, you know, as far as that, Earth being flat, totally flat. I mean, it couldn't be totally flat because there's still a lot of water that would have to surround it. So you know, there's a lot of questions going through my mind right now.
Yes.
The hollow Earth theory, I can't buy that because compressional seismic waves distort that. But anyway.
Well, the Doctrine and Covenants has enough scriptures that refer to the Earth returning to the form in which it was created, which is one landmass and flat. Look those up. I still see hands going up. Yes. I start from the premise that the scriptures are true. That's my boundary conditions. Let me make one closing comment here. You don't remember, but in the pre-existence, there was a so-called war in heaven, and Lucifer and his followers were cast out. That war has not ended. And the general authorities allude to this quite often. In my opinion, the theory of evolution is one of Lucifer's most successful deceptions. He is coming up with every idea he can to overcome the truth and destroy the truth and the gospel. And this is one of his most successful deceptions. It wasn't originated by Darwin and his followers. It was originated by our older brother Lucifer in an attempt to deceive us.
Thanks, Dr. Rollins.